I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire, National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On previous editions of the program, we've tackled the strange, murky events that led to the overthrow of Indonesia's first president, Sukarno, and the brutal regime of his successor, Suharto. That regime carried out a shocking and grotesque wave of mass killings from 1965 to 1966 in the name of fighting communism. In the early morning hours of October 1st, 1965, six Indonesian generals were captured and killed. This event, which, as you will learn in the conversation to follow, remains mired in mystery and controversy. In its aftermath, Suharto seized power and blamed Indonesian communists for the killings. However, this version of what occurred on October 1st, 1965 in Indonesia has come under intense scrutiny and questioning over the years. As previously mentioned, we've broached this topic before on Parallax Views. On this edition of the program, we revisit this topic once again with a new guest. First time on Parallax Views, Greg Pulgrain. Hailing from Brisbane, Australia, Greg is a lecturer at the University of the Sunshine Coast and author of such books as The Genesis of Confrontasi and The Incubus of Intervention, Conflicting Indonesia Strategies of John F. Kennedy and Alan Dulles. In this conversation, we'll be talking about his latest book, JFK vs. Alan Dulles, Battleground Indonesia. It's a very complex story that involves CIA spymaster Alan Dulles, Cold War geopolitics, a discovery of gold in 1936 and its concealment, and, of course, the tragedy of what occurred in Indonesia following the early morning hours of October 1st, 1965. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now on to the conversation with Greg Pulgrain, author of JFK vs. Alan Dulles, Battleground Indonesia. Welcome to Parallax Views, Greg Pulgrain, author of a number of books related to Indonesian history in the 20th century, the latest of which is a very interesting title called JFK vs. Alan Dulles, Battleground Indonesia. How are you doing, Greg?
Well, thanks, JG. Yes, good to speak with you.
Well, this episode has been a long time coming. I think we've corresponded in the past about having you on the show, and finally we got around to it. I guess where I want to start with this book, for listeners that are unfamiliar with Indonesian history, I guess a good place to start would be the figures of President Sukarno and then his successor, President Suharto, who basically brought about this new order, I think was how it's been characterized. Yes. Who was President Sukarno?
Well, he's described by Indonesians and others as the father of the nation, father of independent Indonesia, mainly because he spent his whole life working for Indonesia. He's studied as a student engineer, I think. I think they called it architectural engineering. He graduated and did well, but he just got into politics before it even finished and just carried on from there. And this was in the 1920s. He set up his own political party in the 20s, and at the same time as the Dutch colonial authorities in Netherlands East Indies, they called it then, which became Indonesia, they were clamping down on this new nationalist movement. And Sukarno was one of the top leaders as a nationalist. And he was thrown in jail by the Dutch in the early 1930s. But the amazing thing about that was they let him defend himself. And for 2 days, he spoke in the courtroom defending himself, 2 days nonstop. And he predicted World War II. So he had quite a good grip about regional politics. And during World War II, when the Japanese invaded, the Japanese picked him up from his where he was in detention and brought him in. And he led the people during the war under Japanese tutelage. And at the end of the war, 2 days, on the 17th of August, so that's 2 days after the war ended, with Japanese help, he declared independence for Indonesia. And he remained president for another 20 years, up till 1945 to 65, when Suharto replaced him very violently.
And do you want to get into maybe who Suharto was in comparison to Sukarno and what happened when he got to power? Because it's very haunting and chilling and really horrific what occurs when he gets to power.
Sukarno's parents, he had a Balinese mother, and he became well known for the number of wives that he had, but we tend to regard that in a different way. Indonesia, that's really a mark of respect, you know, that the fact that
he had. Is this Sukarno you're talking about?
Sukarno, sorry, yes. Sukarno carried on, but he was a real politician, quite gifted in speaking. When Suharto was younger, he was back in 1945, during that struggle for independence, he was already in the army, the Dutch army, then the Japanese army, and then the Indonesian army. But he was an army man, basically, and never really gifted in the same way of addressing a crowd. You know, he didn't have that political gift, but he had the Machiavellian streak, I guess. He rose in the army in the 1950s after independence. Well, he came to public view, I suppose, during the struggle for independence, when the Indonesian liberators were trying to fight against the Dutch colonial power. And he became known as the Smiling General, I think, because he had one or two famous instances where he fought against the Dutch. Well, not sure whether he fought. It's recently been claimed while he was fighting in Yogyakarta, which is in central Java. He kicked out the Dutch for 6 or 7 hours. The person who did most of the fighting was another colonel, Colonel Latif. And Colonel Latif later claimed that at, while the fighting was going on, Suharto was back home eating soup. So he did. He wasn't involved in the fighting. But he came to power. He married a woman. His wife was slightly linked with a bit of the royal family, a bit of royal family in Central Java, but he himself was not. But that helped him to gain a bit of notoriety, I suppose, linked to a royal member of the royal, a royal family. He became in charge of a division in Central Java. And mid-50s, he wasn't particularly political at all. Well, he was known to be middle-of-the-road colonel, and he was accused of some smuggling and brought, he had to relinquish his command, and he was brought up to Bandung for a year or so of extra training in the officer training school. But it's always a puzzle because two weeks after he'd arrived at this for reprimand, he was all being promoted. So it's possibly he was brought there for promotion in any case. So from that point on, he became colonel, then he rose up the ranks, and his real rise to fame was when the Dutch and the Indonesians had a disagreement over sovereignty of West New Guinea. Suharto was the man, the army man, put in charge of the campaign against Dutch, 61-62. And in that campaign, Suharto made friends with various army colonels, people who later in 65 he used as his close friends, his close allies. So it's an important for that respect. But Suharto rose through the ranks in 63, 64, 65. That's when confrontation with Malaysia was on. He was the head man in the army, in charge of the army against Malaysia for confrontation. And he was in a group called Kostrad, which is Strategic Command. It's a battalion of highly trained troops. And in that capacity in 1965, he moved in the 30th of September 65, he moved to take control of the army. And in 65, when six generals were killed, the next day he declared himself number one in the army, the head of the army. And from there he went on to become president, replacing Sukarno. So he was, Suharto was the second Indonesian president, but he claimed it through violence, basically. He got it through violence. Sukarno himself was averse to violence, and perhaps had he been more inclined to violence, Suharto would not have risen to power. But he was always more inclined to sit down and talk about it, negotiate. And through that means he basically lost the presidency.
If
so
I could.
Comparing the two,
go on.
Comparing the two, you'd say Sukarno was a real politician, and Suharto was really an army man who became a politician. Yes.
So I want to get into October 1st, 1965, and September 30th, the 30 September movement. But first, I want to say, after Suharto gets to power, I mean, there's just basically widespread mass killings in the name of anti-communism. I mean, it's estimated that 1 million people are just wiped out by this new regime.
Yes. Yeah, it's horrific. It was described later as one of the worst mass murders or massacres in the 20th century. But what struck me was, I think the political officer from the US Embassy in Jakarta, a fellow called Robert Martins, he commented later that Suharto created so much fear. Martins said he'd been through the Cold War in Europe and other places, and yes, there was tension and, you know, but not fear in the same way that Suharto created fear. People literally died of fear, you know. And he was so horrific in treating some of the people. It was like more than a million were actually massacred, but there's another million who were put in detention, and many of those just passed away because lack of food or whatever. I always remember the top Indonesian author, Pramudia Anantatur, told me, he was not awarded the Nobel Prize, but nominated several times. He said he'd lived through the war with the Japanese, who acquired quite a reputation for violence and cruelty, but he said it's not as bad as what Pramudia himself experienced under his fellow Javanese. He said the Javanese are worse. And Suharto is an example of this being prone to violence, you know. Killing a million like that is—it didn't even really. Well, it achieved a purpose, political purpose. But most of these people who died were not. They call them communists, but they were actually rice farmers.
I was going to ask. It seems like, you know, a million people. Not all of them are really going to be communists. So a lot of them were just farmers.
Yeah, rice farmers. They'd become associated with the PKI in the late 50s, early 60s, because they wanted a piece of land to grow their rice on for the family. But they weren't really political. And Sukarno used to explain this to, well, people like President Kennedy. He said, yes, the PKI number 20 million and they're a big party, but 90% of them or 95% of them are rice farmers. They're not really political.
And the PKI is the Communist Party of Indonesia, for my listeners.
The PKI, yes. Partai Communist Indonesia, PKI. But the head of the PKI was a fellow called Adit, and he had some capable people around him, but only one of these PKI top members, only one, was educated at the university level, unlike a lot of the other Indonesian political parties at the time. PKI had only one. But it's extraordinary because at the same time as they had this one who was educated, his brother was head of army intelligence. So it gives you an idea of how Indonesia was mixed up at the time, where one of the top people in the PKI had a brother in Indonesian army, in charge of Indonesian army intelligence. It's a strange mix. Sometimes when the PKI were discussing important things, they'd ask him to go outside the room, please, just to be sure. So that's how crazy situation it was. So the violence that erupted in 1965 on the night of 30th of September or the morning of the 1st of October involved the death of six generals. And the usual way of explaining what happened on that night is that, well, the Suharto story, which is what we've heard for the last, you know, he promoted for the next 30 years when he was president, was that the PKI became planned the death of these generals. But, and he blamed the PKI, and then shortly after, that's when the massacres began. But the actual trucks that picked up the generals on the night were filled with troops from the palace guard. They were trying to defend Sukarno because they'd heard that certain generals were planning a coup on the 5th of October on Armed Forces Day. So a week later, they heard there was going to be a coup. I don't think nobody really knows whether that was true or false or whatever, but the rumor was very strong there was going to be a coup. And Suharto himself had helped to spread this rumor. So the rumor got very strong, and two persons, Untung and Latif, who were in the palace guard and in charge of Jakarta troops, the garrison, got together some troops and decided to pick up 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning to pick up the generals and bring them to President Sukarno to explain themselves. I interviewed Latif later on. He was in jail for 30 years after this, And I was the first person to interview him in jail in 1998. And he told me there was no plan to kill anybody that night. It was not, nobody was going to be killed. You know, they're going to take the generals, bring them before Sukarno and get them to explain, tell us about this so-called coup. But it all went wrong. Well, it went wrong deliberately. This is what I'm saying in the book, because I found new evidence to explain why it went wrong. You know, it didn't just go wrong. Suharto was involved with Untung and Latif, and he was actually involved up to his neck. And in the planning of the, he was aware of what was going to happen. He'd actually brought extra troops to Jakarta from various divisions that he had strong links with in previous years. So on the 5th of October, which was going to be a big celebration of the army, he brought troops that were favourable to him that he could control. And when trouble erupted, he used these same troops to his own advantage to gain power. But on the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, when the trucks were leaving, it took about 30 or 40 minutes for the trucks to drive from where they were at into the central part of Jakarta to pick up the generals. And what I found was in three of the trucks at least, some other men got in plain clothes. They had nothing to do with the palace guard. They were in mufti, or what do you say, plain clothes, armed with Thompson submachine guns. In Indonesian, they call people who wear plain clothes like that and do hitmen, they call them. Basically, they call them preman, P-R-E-M-A-N. And the word basically means somebody in plain clothes who does a job that, like the army, you know, a hit job or a difficult bit of covert operation. You know, they call them preman. So there were actually preman with Thompson submachine guns in at least three of the trucks. And when one of the trucks went to the head of the army's house, a fellow called General Yani, he was head at the time, they went in, and apparently one of these preman went in as well with his submachine gun. And when Yani came down in his pyjamas at 3:30 or something, he said, what's the trouble, you know? And they said, oh, the president wants you to come along and discuss. He said, well, I'll get changed first, you know, and I'll put my uniform on. But somebody said, no, just come as you are. And he said, and he slapped his face, because the head of the army slapped his face, saying, of course I'll get in the uniform if I'm not in my pajamas to see the president. And he turned around and walked off, but they fired 7 bullets and he was dead in seconds. Before he hit the ground, he had 7 bullets in his back. So Yani was killed with a submachine gun. Another general that trucks arrived to pick up was General Nasution.
I was going to ask about Nasution. I believe you spoke to him as well.
Yes, for many, many years. Well, 13 years. I used to visit his house quite often. And it's a bit of a puzzle why Nasution was actually on the list, because the American author who, I forget now, he's written a book called The Killing Fields. Anyway, he's found CIA documents saying that the two top generals the CIA had listed as pro-CIA or anti-PKI, anti-communist, was Nasution and the second was Suharto. But other CIA documents show that Nasution was not the man to replace Sukarno. So basically, Suharto was their top man in waiting in the shadows to take power. So when this group of trucks came along to collect General Nasution, he wasn't in the army. He was Minister of Defense at the time. But he was the most, in the eyes of Suharto, he was the most likely person to stop Suharto from becoming head of the army. So for that reason, I think he may have been included in the list of generals to be wiped out. And when I was, one of my talks with General Nasution, he said, he basically thinks Suharto was involved. Well, he explained this in terms of during that fracas when the trucks came to arrest him, and his wife woke up 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning saying, "You must leave, quick, 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 get out of the room, leave the house, jump over the fence next door," with an embassy next door, so he was safe. But Nasution, being an army man, went to the door saying, "What's the problem?" And he could see straight away that they're going to shoot, so he slammed the door, but he didn't just stand there, he fell straight to the ground and the bullets went through the door and at sort of waist height, but he was underneath the line of fire, so he got up and escaped. But some of the bullets that went around accidentally killed his young daughter. One of the aides of the house was carrying the daughter, rushing across the corridor just at the wrong time, and one of the bullets killed the young daughter. She's about 4 or 5 years old. And from that point on, Nasution told me that his wife always said she blamed Suharto for the death of their daughter, which is basically saying the same as Suharto was behind the whole dirty business of killing the generals, which is really a big accusation, you know. But when I asked him, I said, "Hold on, let's just go through that again. You know, you're saying Suharto was responsible, you know, for killing the generals." And he didn't say anything. He just looked at me. But he's willing to say his wife says that, but he's not. He doesn't want to say it because Suharto at the time was still alive, you see, still president. So he's had to be very careful. He'd already gotten into trouble. They called it a group of 50 top people, including quite a lot of generals, had criticized President Suharto in just before 98 when he was, well, a few years before. They call it the group of 50, and quite a few were put in jail, in prison. Nasution himself, because he was so, you know, former Minister of Defence and former leader of the army, but he got into a bit of trouble, and that's why he was very careful still with what he was saying, because he knew Suharto was ruthless, basically.
Well, he barely survived with his life on October 1st, 1965. I believe he scaled a wall, and I think he ended up hiding, if I remember from the book correctly, in an Iraqi ambassador's residence.
Yeah, next door, yes. Yeah, well, he got shot. Well, he was hurt. He damaged his foot climbing over the wall, but they were shooting at him as he jumped over the wall. But they knew they couldn't go there because it was an embassy ground. But it's interesting, about an hour later, that one of these Preman was outside, still outside the house. Well, there were two there. One was smoking a cigarette. An Australian journalist arrived at about 5:30 in the morning and saw them there. And there was another report that another general arrived looking for Nasution, and he called out, "En Nas," as in Nasution, "Nas, Nas, where are you? Where are you?" You know, and Nasution could hear him because he's hiding in the garden next door. But he realized if he put his head up and said, "Over here," that they'd open fire and try to kill him. So he said nothing. He got out of the garden, you know, 4 or 5 hours later when things had calmed down. But at the time he didn't want to put his head up because he would have been killed. And the rest of the generals, one other general was killed as he was being kidnapped, and three other generals, well, I should say at Nasution's house, there was a lieutenant there who came down to find out what was happening. And the people who charged in with guns took this lieutenant, and he was actually killed later on. They said a mistake was made. They thought he was General Nasution. But that, it doesn't even make sense, that excuse, because they'd already been shooting at Nasution and he jumped over the fence. So the question in the book, as I said, the question was, why did they take this adjutant and shoot him? And the reason I'm putting forward in the book is that he must have seen Preman. See, the idea that Preman were involved has never been brought up in the last 50, since 1965. It's never been mentioned that Preman were involved. And this is like new history. Yeah? It explains really what happened on that night, because Preman did the killing.
So basically Hitman.
Yeah. Hitman with Thompson submachine guns. But it's never been mentioned in the court proceedings that went on after Stalin 65. They went on for years. They went on for decades, 15 years of court proceedings. Never was a Preman brought to court. It wasn't even mentioned, you know. If it was mentioned, people would say, what's going on? You know, what were Preman doing mixing in with palace guard? You know, something's wrong, you know. That's why they didn't want Preman involved in any court proceedings. It would have let the cat out of the bag, see. But I found a document in the library of Indonesia, University of Indonesia Library. It's actually a government publication. It's been there for years and years, and no one's even looked at it, which explained that Preman were involved in the kidnapping. And the only reason people didn't look at this book is on the cover, it had the name of the head of the Communist Party, PKI. Aidit was head of the PKI, and it had his name, the death of Aidit or something. And because of the trauma and fear that was created for 20 years afterwards, nobody even wanted to be seen, I think, looking at this book in the library, you see. So it just remained untouched. And it's been there untouched for years. And Nasution actually had a small 10-page section written by him in the book. And various people contributed chapters in the book. But obviously, Suharto never read the book. Otherwise, he would never have put it in. It was a government publication in the library. Amazing. And that's where the word came that Preman were involved on the night, on that vital night.
So this is important. When it comes to the assassination of these six generals and this 30 September movement, what's interesting, especially since you mentioned how Nasution and his wife viewed it, his wife in particular viewing it as, oh, Suharto was behind this. Suharto's version of events is that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, that it was the PKI. This was a coup by the PKI, and ultimately, this is how Suharto basically takes control of Jakarta and gets these mass purges underway, creating a hysteria about communism.
Yes. He blamed the PKI from day one. He'd been preparing that case for some time, and it really fitted in neatly with sort of the rumor that had been doing some Western diplomatic circles for a few months earlier, saying the PKI are going to attempt a coup and it will fail and the army will strike back and eliminate them. This was the rumor going around. Someone must have leaked it, but it was exactly what happened. You know, the PKI were not involved at all in the actual trucks that went to pick up the generals. The person that Suharto accused of being representing the PKI and organising it on behalf of Aidit was Aidit's top man called Shum, S-J-A-M, Shum. But what I've shown in the book is that Shum, he was working with Aidit, yes, but he had a longer association with Suharto himself. He went right back to the independence struggle. They were together in the independence struggle, Shum and Suharto. And I found that Shum, when Suharto was commander of Kostrad in strategic command, that is, with the green berets, in 1965, Shum, in 1965, even though he was working under PKI, somehow managed to walk in and out of Kostrad headquarters as though he he owned the place, you know. He had amazing facility to walk in and out, and he said, well, it's because I'm gathering information. But actually, in retrospect, his association with Suharto was very close. I think it's an interesting story. I included it in a footnote, I think. And when Sham was being arrested after this event, it took 3 years, even though all the PKI people were arrested immediately, within days or weeks, and, you know, killed. Some were just killed, shot in the street. I think one was brought to trial, but basically the lot of them were arrested and dispensed with. Not Sham. He was arrested. He took 3 years to arrest him. He was in Bandung. He was hiding in Bandung. And when the Indonesian counterintelligence officer finally found out where Sham was hiding, the procedure was he'd notify his boss, and his boss would then tell Suharto, we found Sham. We're going to arrest him at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know. And the first time that happened, the Indonesian army officer went along to arrest him at six, and Sham had gone. Somebody had told him, of course, you know. Okay, he thought that was a bit of bad luck. It happened again. They found out where he was. He followed the same procedure. We'll arrest him at 6 o'clock in the morning. And someone told him again. So Sham had disappeared when they went along at 6 in the morning for a second time. The third time, the arresting officer followed procedure, but then went straight along and arrested Sham. He didn't wait till 6 o'clock in the morning. Eh? But he realized Suharto was leaking information to Sham, and it was very dangerous on his behalf to arrest Sham. So he gave the details of Sham's arrest to the top journalist in Jakarta at that time, a photograph under a street name with a newspaper there with the date of the newspaper, so it identified who it was, where he was, the time, etc. And then the Indonesian army officer went along to Suharto to announce the arrest, and he thought Suharto might kill him, you know? But he didn't. He let him go, and a year later, then he struck. Then Suharto got him and arrested him and nearly killed him, but he survived. And the interesting thing was, because of that happening, that Indonesian army officer who was in charge of counterintelligence spent the rest of his life like some, he became a Christian, and he was a monk. He became like a monk going around the countryside helping families of PKI who'd been persecuted and suffered terribly. I mean, these are rice farmers. If the man in the family was killed, then sometimes the wife and the children were just left destitute and really suffered for years. It's been a generational thing. Even today, some PKI people, this is 50, 60 years later, because their grandfather was a PKI member, they're still suffering the consequences today. It's not as bad, of course, but for the first generation, it was really bad. I came across a woman in Malang once whose father was PKI and he was executed. And she at the time was about 12 years old and her elder brother was about 15. But because he, as a 15-year-old boy, he was being persecuted so much by neighbours and whatever, you know, friends in the town, whatever, he actually took poison and killed himself. Amazing. It was just such suffering these people went through. It's unbelievable. And they didn't even know what had happened, you know. When we look at the big geopolitical picture, I mean, we have to say, why kill so many rice farmers? What's the point, you know? It doesn't do anything. I mean, even the top political officer in the US embassy, a fellow called Masters, he said the PKI, if the PKI was involved, he said they would, 5,000, once the top 5,000 members were eliminated, then the army could have achieved exactly what they wanted anyway. So why kill another million? You know, what's going on? And some people say, oh, well, that's just the, you know, Indonesians running amok, and they sometimes accuse Muslims of killing them because they were thought they were infidels. But it's since been proven the army was organizing people accused Muslims, and other some Christians as well were involved in killing communists. But it's really been pointed out that the army was involved in all of the organizing of the killing that went on, which was a desperate situation. So it's an interesting story that intelligence officer spent the rest of his life is sort of trying to make amends, I think, helping in some way address the poverty of these people who were, in his opinion, wrongly accused of being involved in the killing of the generals.
Go on.
Well, that was an early morning event, the killing of the generals. And then during the day, Suharto pretended basically to be on the side, to continue to be on the side of Untung and Latif. But by 2 o'clock, another radio announcement was made. The first radio announcement was 7 o'clock saying generals had been kidnapped. They didn't say they'd been killed, just kidnapped. And 2 o'clock, another announcement was made. And that was the announcement that Suharto later claimed was the PKI, the example of the PKI attempting a coup, because in that announcement, it was claimed, PKI announcement, that they wanted to replace Sukarno's cabinet and do this and do that. And on that basis, it was seen to be a coup. But as I've said in the book, Suharto and the link between Suharto and Sham, I think, led to this second announcement, because the people who allegedly signed this document later on claimed they had nothing to do with it. It was manufactured. And it seems to me to be Suharto and Sham together prepared this 2 o'clock announcement, which was going to be described as the PKI coup. And it's interesting that another scholar, She wrote a book called Mechanics of Mass Murder. Anyway, about 10 years ago now, she found out that from documents she'd retrieved in Aceh, she found out that Suharto had organized the whole procedure of killing before the event actually occurred. And he'd sent an order at 10 o'clock in the morning. I mean, the announcement was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, remember? So he sent an order at 2 o'clock to Aceh to start rounding up the PKI because they were involved in an attempted coup. But the 2 o'clock announcement hadn't even been announced. So he was obviously running ahead of time. And if you wanted to ask me, that was one of the main mistakes Suharto made in his whole career, because it points the finger directly at the preparation that he'd prepared and his personal involvement in the actual killing that proceeded for the next, well, for years, but mainly for the next 1 or 2 years. Huh?
I was going to add real quickly, the author in question, I think you were referring to, was Jess Melvin, author of Mechanics of Mass Murder. I think the bottom line with this October 1st event in those early morning hours is that it doesn't seem like there was a coup attempt by the PKI or Indonesian Communist Party vis-a-vis the 30 September movement and the assassination of these six generals. It seems like the real coup was ultimately Suharto being able to seize power, and ultimately, this renders Sukarno basically a lame duck, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yes, Suharto, well, later on claimed that he slept through all this killing that occurred, and he was awakened in the morning by a neighbor who'd somehow heard it, and this is about 5:30 in the morning. But considering the gravity of a situation like that, you know, where the top army commander had been kidnapped and killed, he still didn't arrive at work until 7 o'clock, after 7 o'clock. You know? And one of the generals, when he walked into his Kostrad headquarters, one of the generals there later revealed that the first thing he asked was, "Where is Sham?" So obviously he thought Sham was involved in the killing. But Suharto's top intelligence man, Ali Murtopo, who became in later years like next 10, 15 years, became known as the architect of the new order, that is the new military regime that took over Indonesia. Ali Motopo had lots of brilliant ideas on how to extract the most and benefit the army the most. And he was involved, I think, on the night when those trucks were going in to collect the generals. And as I said before, no, Latif told me no one was to be killed. It was no killing was not on the agenda. But Latif wasn't there, Untung wasn't there, they were both in Jakarta. Somebody else came out to reissue orders, and I think that person was Ali Motopo, because he was at the right command. He knew the person in command of the trucks and everything. And he had the right authority, the right level, the right experience, and also the right degree of intrigue to issue a new command, where he said dead or alive, not just kidnapped, but dead or alive. And that's through him, these plainclothes men sneaked on through him, and Shum, the plainclothes men, got on the trucks and were included in the palace troops when they went to kidnap the generals, and through them the death occurred. It was Suharto's doing. When you read the book,
real quick, this is like essentially, it seems like this is almost like something like a false flag.
Yes, I did explain earlier how this rumor about the Council of Generals, they call it, they were planning this so-called coup, how this came about, because nobody has ever really tried to explain that. But I found records in the archives in London explaining how it came about, because it was a combination of British and US intelligence, how they initiated this rumor of the Council of Generals, how they impressed, aided actually, with the idea that the Council of Generals was going to seize power from Sukarno very soon, you know? And they said the 5th of October, that's why they agreed the 30th of September to make a move. But the actual British-US alliance was complete, I call it like a false rumor, a false coup, but it was recorded in the records as the British embassy in Bangkok was going to kidnap Sukarno, and their friends in Jakarta, the army, were going to seize power. Okay, that was pretty simple and was just not very, very unlikely to happen, of course. But this was leaked by a person in Bangkok, and the British embassy was leaked over to Washington, so that Dean Rusk in Washington called in the British ambassador and said, what's going on? You know, this is nonsense. You can't, you know, he really reprimanded him. He called it a half-baked coup. And it seemed like when this was recorded, it seemed like Dean Rusk was stopping the British from attempting to kidnap Sukarno in Bangkok, which is a complete nonsense story. But when that news came back to Jakarta, it put the pressure off the Americans, and Dean Rusk was involved, by the way. He wasn't just Secretary of State for Kennedy. This was 65 anyway. It was under Johnson at the time. But anyway, it was a bit earlier. But Dean Rusk was involved personally. So it did involve American and British intelligence, but because the British were already at war or in conflict through Malaysian confrontation, most of the accusation was directed against the British, and it seemed to alleviate, I think, the pressure on the US in Jakarta at the time. Of course, the person in the embassy in Jakarta who came in was Marshall Green.
And this is Marshall all before Green. October 1st, just for my listeners. This yes. is the Council of Generals rumor that sort of seems to mirror the claims of this 30th September movement.
Yes. They got particularly worried by what was happening here. So that it really prompted or provoked the idea of a coup in the minds of Untung and Latif. They wanted to defend their president, Sukarno, so they thought they should act against this so-called Council of Generals. And that's really what motivated the original idea of kidnapping the generals and bringing them to Sukarno.
I guess where I was going to go next, this September 30th movement, like I said, it seems to almost be a false flag. It's really not the PKI behind it. It seems like it's actually Suharto, and the real coup ends up being how Suharto gets to power using this 30th September, blaming the PKI for it as the pretext for a sort of hostile takeover. I guess yes. From there, what we have to get into is the question of the CIA. How does the CIA and the U.S. figure into all of this?
Well, Marshall Green seems to be the key figure. His top man in Marshall Green was a China expert, by the way, and he was with Nixon and Kissinger when the famous visit to China was made in the early 72, 73 period. Marshall Green was with them. But it's interesting that the top man from Moscow, the top man in the US Embassy from Moscow, John Martins, was brought over to Jakarta at this time, 63. So he was there for a few years as well. So here in Jakarta, you've got the top China expert and the top Soviet expert working in the US Embassy in Jakarta. Why? Because the strategy was to use the PKI as that wedge to split Moscow and Beijing. And you've got the two US experts working together in Jakarta at the time. It's incredible.
So this
really
would all serve a very specific geopolitical function within the context of the Cold War between the US and Russia.
Yes, in the late 1950s, 58, 59, the Rockefeller brothers panel report produced information that they wanted to drive a wedge, they said, a wedge between Moscow and Beijing. And how to do that at the time may not have been evident, but it soon became evident that the best way to do it was to pursue this Sino-Soviet dispute. They were having a dispute over ideological issues. And basically, Moscow wanted more support against Beijing in this dispute. And so they turned to the next biggest communist party in the world outside Sino-Soviet bloc. It was the PKI in Indonesia. And for the same reason, Beijing, or Peking, they call it then, Beijing was looking to the PKI for the same reason, to get support from the PKI to use that against Moscow. And people, well, we in the West have somehow forgotten the degree of animosity that was then between Moscow and Beijing, because it really reached a desperate stage in after late 60s when Beijing was considering that Moscow was going to drop an atomic bomb. And at midday, they'd have trials where sirens would go off and everybody on the street in Beijing would then go underground in a for a mock rescue operation in case the bomb was being dropped. So that's how serious it was, this animosity between Beijing and Moscow. So it was really, really bad. And that's what led to eventually to Nixon and Kissinger befriending Beijing. They visited Beijing in 72. But 1965 in Indonesia, or 66, when the PKI was eliminated, was the key that set Moscow and Beijing literally fighting each other, because each blamed the other for this amazing atrocity that occurred in Indonesia. And they each blamed the other for this tragedy. They started tank battles. Moscow and Beijing started tank battles up around Vladivostok on the Ussuri River, up just north on the Pacific side of Soviet Union. Big tank battles that not many people seem to know about. The first person to bring this to my attention was a retired president of Indonesia, Adam Malik. He'd just retired in 1983. And I'd been to an interview with in Tokyo with the top Japanese expert on Indonesia, a fellow called Nishijima. And as I was leaving, he just said, oh, maybe I could help you get a few interviews in Jakarta, you know. Would you like to see? That's how I got to Nasution. I got to Adam Malik the same way. So when I called in to see Adam Malik in his house in Jakarta a few months later, he'd just retired as vice president. But what I didn't realize was he retired because he was dying of cancer, and he died less than a year later. But when he was talking to me, he was speaking as though he wanted to get off his chest a whole lot of things before he died. And I, so much that it became obvious to me, he was giving me details that you could only get if you were part of the CIA, you see. So his...
What was the most telling thing he revealed to you?
Just about the CIA involvement and U-2 flights and things like that. That he was telling me details about U-2 flights were used in the New Guinea's the struggle over sovereignty of West New Guinea. But the interesting thing was that his adjutant, a fellow called Ade Yatman, was sitting next to him during the interview, and people described him as CIA, but much more soon, like a decade before they later described Malik. Only 10 or 15 years after his death was he described as CIA. I didn't know at the time, you see. So Ade Yatman was telling Malik, oh, please, please, boss, you shouldn't say these things to Greg, you know, during this interview, you know. These are a bit private. And he turned around to Ade Yatman and said, you be quiet. I'll tell him if I want to tell him, you know. Because he was trying to basically unburden his conscience, I think, with the massive killing that occurred, which I don't think he anticipated. He was involved in it, and he was up to his neck in replacing Sukarno, but I don't think he anticipated this huge tragedy that occurred, which really was at the doing more of Marshall Green than anybody else. I found that Marshall Green had actually somehow arranged for two US personnel, a man and a woman, to be present in Central Java in mid-1966, when the killing was raging there and thousands were being killed. These man and a woman used to, US personnel, I imagine they were, where they came from, I don't know, but I think direct from America. They probably didn't come from the US Embassy in Jakarta. Several were brought over from America, I think. And there was a US ship from the 7th Fleet offshore, and they would transport the man and the woman from the ship to a place called Klaten. It was in Central Java, former PKI headquarters. 20 minutes would take to get there. They'd then supervise the Indonesian army, who were busily involved in decimating the PKI, killing the PKI. Then when nighttime came, they'd fly back to the ship and they'd sleep on the ship, have dinner, wake up, come back to work in the morning. I'm not sure how long this went on for, but it has been reported. And I've got telegrams from Marshall Green to the head of intelligence of the 7th Fleet requesting transport, which I'm interpreting to be the helicopter that took them. So it's US was Marshall Green, I'd say. I wouldn't say US. Marshall Green's representatives were directly involved in the killing and this massacre that occurred. And the logic behind the killing was that the more people killed, the greater the argument was between Moscow and Peking. And that's how it worked out. That's why they started shooting each other, shooting at each other, you know, because the PKI were absolutely eliminated.
Now,
sorry, go on.
Since we've been talking about how this whole event unfolded, I guess we've been building up to maybe the title of your book, JFK versus Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles, of course, for people that are younger that may be unfamiliar, director of the CIA, very important spy master type figure. How does he figure into this story? Because I believe he's out of his position in the CIA in 1961. So how does he tie into this for my listeners that may be a little confused by that?
Well, he was, Kennedy ushered him out after the Bay of Pigs. But he went back. He didn't go to the new CIA headquarters. He went to the old ones in what they call Foggy Bottom, I think, in Washington, and stayed there for a while. But he remained in a very powerful position, as was pointed out by who's the US author who wrote about the Devil's Chessboard?
David Talbot.
Yes. He said, actually, even on the day of Kennedy's assassination, he was still involved in CIA activities. And the main point that I've put forward was that Dulles was talking about ousting Sukarno. Alan Dulles was talking about ousting Sukarno way back in 1955. And he was attempting, he had very six or seven attempted assassinations that didn't work. And then he got a different strategy together. And even though he was removed from the Director of Central Intelligence position in late 61 by Kennedy, he remained very powerful because of his links. I mean, Director of Central Intelligence means not just CIA. It's about 10 intelligence organizations, Army, Navy, Air Force, whatever. And he was really in a very powerful position for years afterwards. And what I also pointed out in the book was that he had his own networks involved. And these, for example, in the Warren Commission, which was 63-64, he was one of the key witnesses in the Warren Commission was somebody that he'd known since he was 10 years old, since the witness was 10 years old, a fellow called George de Morenschild. And another instance was the actual interview, Library of Congress interview by
Thomas Braden.
Yeah, the Library of Congress interviews available on the net sort of thing. But he's interviewing Alan Dulles in 64, I think it was. And even then, Dulles is talking to the interviewer about important or a secret event that he can't talk about relating to Indonesia. So obviously he's still involved in Indonesia. It's amazing.
What's his involvement in 1958? There's the whole Outer Island Rebellion, and I think a CIA officer, his plane is shot down. I think Alan Pope. He goes on trial in Jakarta.
Yes, well, Alan Dulles was personally responsible for the 1958 rebellion, and that's probably when it becomes really apparent that the CIA is operating quite differently to what the US government was, because State Department, because the US ambassador at the time, Allison, in Jakarta, later wrote a book mentioning Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles too, who was Secretary of State, but saying that Alan Dulles was just completely out of control.
What leads to the falling out with Kennedy?
Yes, well, I think that during the 50s, Alan Dulles was getting to know Kennedy quite well. Kennedy at the time in the 50s was a senator, and he had that trouble with his back, and he was at times quite sick. He wrote that book, Profiles of Courage, in the mid-50s. And during this period, Alan would be going over to his house and talking with him about foreign affairs. And it's quite amazing that you can see he's getting to know that this person, Kennedy, is anti-colonial, and he'd be a good person to be in position of power when Alan Dulles wanted an anti-colonial in power to take away New Guinea from the colonial Dutch. And that's exactly how he helped. Alan Dulles helped President Kennedy, even though he's Republican. He helped Kennedy,
him
the Democrat,
against Nixon.
against Nixon to get into power. Quite remarkable. And the other amazing thing that I find is that what you mentioned, the 1958 rebellion, which in most history books is described as a CIA failure. And I'm saying, no, it wasn't. It's just because Dulles had a different way of operating, whereby he could make a failure like that, turn a failure into his advantage. And in this case, he was not intending really for the CIA, for the Outer Islands Rebellion, even though he gave CIA assistance. He did not want it to succeed. The main idea in that rebellion was not to break up Indonesia into various bits, but to get an army headquarters in Jakarta instead of army separated in half a dozen headquarters all over the archipelago, which was what the army was like beforehand. Alan Dulles unified the army through that rebellion, by means of that rebellion. And the other point was Alan Dulles, and if you remember the name, what's his name? Jesus Angleton, the head of CIA.
Angleton, yeah.
Yes, counterintelligence. Both of them were quite often having lunch together with Philby, the CIA, CIA British intelligence liaison. He was MI6, sent over as the top intelligence man to liaise with the CIA in the mid-50s, so in early 50s. And when it became apparent that Philby was a Russian spy, Angleton reacted rather badly and got quite a lot of mental pressure, I think, because he'd been having lunch with this person for years, you know. But people forget that Alan Dulles did also. But Alan Dulles reacted in a different way. He became extremely more careful about when he was planning an operation. For example, the Bay of Pigs, you know. I mean, we say people tend to blame Kennedy, they say, because he didn't provide air cover for the Bay of Pigs. Well, but from Dulles' point of view, whether the Bay of Pigs succeeded, that is, initially succeeded even without air cover, or failed, it would have suited Dulles' intention, because the idea was to increase the Cold War tension. And in the New Guinea sovereignty dispute, it was basically handing West New Guinea over to Sukarno rather than supporting the Dutch. Kennedy would be expected to really to have supported the Dutch because they were NATO allies, but he didn't. He asked the Dutch to leave, relinquish sovereignty of New Guinea, give it to President Sukarno, and then Kennedy was planning to build up Indonesia into a pro-US ally in the Cold War. But Dulles wanted West New Guinea handed over to Sukarno, although he never admitted that. He wanted it because 18 months or 30 months later, he realized Sukarno was going to be replaced by a military regime. That's why he wanted the Dutch. Alan Dulles wanted the Dutch out of New Guinea and New Guinea to be put under Indonesian sovereignty. And then, but not under, he was under Sukarno for a short time, but he was, at the time, he's already planning to replace Sukarno with a military regime. So
you're saying he's playing chess. He's thinking ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. He's real Machiavellian in the extreme.
So before we close out, first off, I want to mention briefly, I mentioned him helping President Kennedy. If I remember from the book correctly, that has to do with a foreign policy debate that Kennedy and Nixon had, where Kennedy was briefed and Nixon was sort of left in the dark, so yes. Kennedy was able to perform better.
Take advantage, yes.
What's that?
Sorensen, Kennedy's speechwriter, Sorensen later said that television debate basically won the election for Kennedy. Was such a narrow margin of voting that got him over the line. They think it was in Sorensen's opinion, it was the advantage given to Kennedy, which he took advantage of in that television debate. Eh? And who gave Kennedy the advantage? It was Dulles. Eh? So you could expect Kennedy, JFK, felt a little bit, obliged to say thank you to Alan Dulles for that help he gave shortly before the television debate. And that could be a reason why he reappointed Alan Dulles and Edgar Hoover within a day, I think. He reappointed them their positions that they'd had for ages. Hoover was FBI and Alan Dulles was head of the CIA. And they were the first persons to be reappointed by Kennedy's new administration. And people warned Kennedy at the time, but Alan Dulles should not be trusted. I mean, the person who was warning him was the previous, Eisenhower, you remember, issued a warning because he knew how Dulles operated, and Eisenhower was Republican. So there must have been some pressure. I think Kennedy thought a bipartisan approach would be the best way to go. And I think he had, 15 Rhodes scholars in his administration, which was amazing, really. Yeah.
What's the difference, ultimately, between how Kennedy wanted to approach Indonesia and how Dulles wanted to approach it?
Well, Kennedy's trip to Jakarta would have succeeded. That's why they had to stop it. Had it gone ahead, it would have stopped Malaysian confrontation. U.S. aid would have helped Sukarno remain president, but U.S. aid would have helped Indonesia become an ally of the U.S. in the Cold War. It would have diminished the PKI. People were joining the PKI because they had nothing. So if the standard of living rose, which was Kennedy's intention, the PKI would have sort of slowly faded away. But it would have worked, but over years. Dulles wanted it to act immediately because he wanted to take advantage of the Sino-Soviet rift, which he didn't tell Kennedy about, you see. That was kept away from Kennedy's. He wasn't briefed. Nor was Kennedy briefed about the gold in New Guinea either. But in 63, the Sino-Soviet rift had been becoming almost on the point of becoming obvious, but not quite, because it was still debated, is it a Cold War trick? And people like Angleton were saying it was, So Dulles' approach, on the other hand, with Indonesia was to replace Sukarno with a military regime, and that's what they did. Sukarno, Dulles didn't like, because even though he called him a communist, Sukarno wasn't a communist. Kennedy knew he wasn't. Even Nixon said Sukarno was a nationalist, So, but Dulles insisted in calling him communist, and that's why the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I think, in late 63 would have supported the idea that Kennedy's proposed trip to Jakarta, which would have got Kennedy re-elected, maybe got him a Nobel Peace Prize, it would have enabled him to proceed with his strategy for Indonesia, for keeping Sukarno in power, for helping Indonesia. It was just the opposite to what Alan Dulles wanted, which was remove Sukarno from power, because he would have put Indonesia first,
Basically, Dulles wanted regime change immediately, and Kennedy wasn't going to play regime change games with Sukarno.
Not at all. Okay. No, yeah. Regime change as quickly as possible. And it came very soon afterwards, yes. And it was brutal, violent in the extreme. Kennedy's alternative would never even have happened. This massive killing in Indonesia would not have happened had Kennedy's plan proceeded. Mind you, the Vietnam War, the American participation in the war would not have gone ahead either in the same way. But in Indonesia, it was this huge massacre that occurred, which is still traumatizing people today in Indonesia. It was so vast. It would not have happened had Kennedy's plan proceeded.
So last question, I promise to let you go after this because I know I've kept you a little bit over time. And just as a side note to all of this, it seems like Kennedy wanted to work within, or he wanted to use diplomacy, whereas Alan Dulles was all about using covert operations and sort of dirty tricks. I guess the last thing I wanted to ask you, though, is you mentioned this gold discovery, and it plays a large part in your book. If we could just get into that for a few minutes, what is this gold discovery that happens in the 1930s, and why is it so central to the story you tell in JFK versus Alan Dulles, Battleground Indonesia?
Pre-war. Yeah, gold was discovered in Netherlands, New Guinea in 1936. What was so surprising about it was the size of this primary gold deposit was absolutely enormous, twice as big as the biggest gold mine in the world. But it wasn't announced publicly. It was kept quiet. And the man who formed the company, the geologist and two other Dutchmen participated in the people who found the gold in 1936, they were in a company called Netherlands New Guinea Petroleum Company, which was formed by Alan Dulles as part of his link with Standard Oil. So Alan Dulles was in the know about the potential wealth. It had oil, it had gold, and, well, it ended up being gas and whatever. It was huge natural resources in West New Guinea, and that's the problem that it's got today. It's Papuans are just sitting on a gold mine. And so when the post-war years, this gold still was not announced, and it played a significant role in the sovereignty dispute over West New Guinea, because when it came to a head in 1962 with the New York Agreement, the gold could have been under Dutch control if the Dutch kept New Guinea, but Alan Dulles didn't want it. He wanted it under Indonesian control, because the military regime was, coming up soon after. It caused a real problem in 1961, because there was intervention from the United Nations in the form of Dag Hammarskjöld. Dag Hammarskjöld was going to intervene to sort out this dispute over sovereignty between the Dutch and the Indonesians, each of them claiming sovereignty of West New Guinea. But Dag Hammarskjöld, or Kennedy, who supported him, did not know about the gold in New Guinea. And it provides a very strong motive for Dulles becoming involved in the crash of the plane that did away with Dag Hammarskjöld in the Congo. Because had Dag Hammarskjöld intervened, as he was planning to in 1961, in the General Assembly, 1961, he was going to end the dispute over sovereignty, kick out the Dutch, kick out Indonesia, the Papuans' independence, and this would have lost access, lost sovereign Standard Oil, Alan Dulles, that is, who's linked with Standard Oil. John Foster was married in the family of the Rockefeller family, but Alan was just a key operator. He didn't marry into the family, but he was very close with Standard Oil since the 1920s, basically. And it would have lost Standard Oil control over the world's biggest gold mine, which is still operating today in West New Guinea. The gold was initially said to be 2 ounces of gold per ton. But when I interviewed Jean-Jacques Dozy, who found the gold in 1936, he said, no, it's 15 grams per ton. So it's like, seven times more than the official announcement. So one has to ask, what is happening with this gold in New Guinea? Because Freeport have remained, the actual percentage of gold being exported has remained the same since day one. Well, it's increased lately because the overall mine has increased, but it's still that same very low percentage, which is, according to the man I spoke with, incorrect. So there's a big cover-up occurring there, which really needs to be investigated. The Indonesian government was talking about investigation, and I was going to address the parliament there at one stage, but it did not happen, put it that way. And people have been getting payoffs or being paid off for some time because just to maintain that massive gold mine in West New Guinea. It's the person who told me about the payoffs was the top lawyer from Indonesia, who actually saw physical evidence of payoffs occurring when, in the time of Suharto, for example, Suharto was getting paid a certain amount from that mine and going into some account somewhere, probably, I don't know, perhaps a Swiss account. He didn't know, but some account was being added to on a regular basis from the Freeport mine into Suharto's account to keep it operating.
U.S. moneyed interests that also have an interest in what happens.
Absolutely, yes.
At this
but
time.
Okay. What I would like, I mean, what about Freeport shareholders? I mean, what's going on? So, someone in America, you know, I've put it on the table, put it that way. This is what I found. There is a discrepancy. Please, someone in New York can look into it.
In closing, what would you like my listeners, if they pick up JFK versus Alan Dulles Battleground Indonesia and read it, what do you hope they get out of it? And also, if you could just briefly here, because I know someone wanted me to ask this question, what would you say to people that look at this book and say, oh, you're blaming Dulles for everything, you're treating him like too much of a mastermind? How would you respond to people who think that you're viewing Dulles as the sole chess player?
He's not the sole. I mean, he's certainly brilliant, but obviously he's got a huge team supporting, friends and allies and companies. Yes, he's a key figure because I think he was the man who came up with the ideas, and others were needed, of course, to implement them. He certainly didn't do them all by himself. And how to walk away with the idea. I think Kennedy's idea of what to do with Indonesia would have been nowhere, it would not have been a violent ending in the same way that Alan Dulles' strategy of Indonesia ended up with millions dead. So, and the importance of Kennedy's proposed visit to Jakarta really brings to light just a way of looking at the whole Kennedy saga that explains things for the first time, that the mystery about Kennedy's assassination, seen in a different light, seen in the idea of rivalry between Moscow and Peking involving Indonesia and Cold War politics, very big Cold War politics, is really explains the Kennedy assassination in a way that it hasn't been done before. I mean, the gold is involved, yes, but it's really, I think, what got the Joint Chiefs to support the tragedy that occurred in 63 was the idea of Kennedy intervening in the Cold War strategy that would have benefited America, USA, and Kennedy's proposed trip to Jakarta would have disrupted Dulles' plan, and Kennedy was going to use his charisma in Jakarta to stop Konfrontasi, to keep Sukarno as president.
And thus it would have potentially or theoretically impacted the Sino-Soviet split. And of course, due to the events of 1965, the overthrow of President Sukarno and the mass killings that followed, the tensions between Moscow and Beijing were deepened.
It was, yes. Well, Kennedy was going to defuse that, you see. He wasn't, because he wasn't aware of it, you know. Dulles didn't inform him about that. Even Sukarno wasn't aware of the gold in New Guinea. It was purely sort of political reckonings that he was dealing with. It's amazing what Dulles got away with. He was involved in Indonesia in the 1920s, and he was involved in intelligence even before John Kennedy was born. Alan Dulles was already involved in intelligence, which gives you some idea of the depth of experience this fellow had when Kennedy really confronted him in the 60s. And a brilliant operator, a prodigy, I'd say, because I always remember he wrote the book on the Boer War. Alan Dulles wrote the book on the Boer War when he was 8 years old. Now, that's quite remarkable, quite remarkable.
Well, I want to thank you, Greg Pulgrain, for coming on Parallax Views. If there's anything else you'd like to add that I missed, or just what you'd like listeners to get out of this conversation or get out of the book, and maybe tell my listeners how they can purchase the book if they're interested in it.
Well, it's because of COVID, it's online. Yeah, it's not across the counter in the bookshop. So online, it's available through various agencies like Amazon or some of the big agencies like that. But you have to, you just check on, you can put in JFK versus Alan Dulles and it can just buy it online in a few minutes. But I think it's a fairly reasonable price, $25 or something. But the actual work involved in this is, well, it's taken a long time, put it mildly, a very long time. And I've gradually compiled all the evidence. And I think it should change. Well, as George Kahin told me years ago, he used to be a top American Indonesia expert. He was saying, you know, once my research is understood a bit better, it will change our perspective on the history of this region. So I'm hoping that will happen, but it's COVID seems to have interrupted the idea of spreading the word quickly after the book was published in November. But I hope people do hear about the contents of the book, that it's a new explanation. Well, the explanation, I think, for Kennedy's assassination and just the tragedy that's occurred as a result, you know, the killing in Indonesia and the continued killing of people in West New Guinea because of their great wealth, gold and oil and gas and timber and everything. And here they are in 1961 on the verge of independence. And it seems to be as far away as ever today because the Indonesian army is basically beyond the control of the Indonesian government in that region of West New Guinea. So it's an ongoing tragedy.
Well, I hope that one day that tragedy will end and that, you know, a brighter future will prevail. I want to thank you once again, Greg Pulgrane, for coming on Parallax Views. Everyone, please check out JFK versus Alan Dulles, Battleground Indonesia.
Thank you, JG.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Greg Pulgrane, author of JFK vs. Alan Dulles, Battleground Indonesia. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.